Right. So we have in this room a really nice collection of people from across the disciplines, economists as well as theologians and moral philosophers and many others as well. So I think our conversation is going to be as broadly conceived as your book itself. So we welcome questions from any sort of angle of entry on this really interesting cultural critique. Don't be shy. Yes. Could you introduce yourself, everyone, please?
Sure. I'm Adam Thomas. I'm a graduate student of political science. Since the Great Recession a few years ago was not the first sort of economic catastrophe in this country, I'd like you to say more, I guess, about what specifically caused that, and connect it to your theory about the change in American life as opposed to prior ones. Which would
have
taken place before the...
Yeah, and I'm maybe a little weak on the ones before, but I did spend a good part of the last formal chapter is mostly about the housing bubble, a little bit about Iraq and invasion. I guess what struck me about this one was the level of deception, the deception on every level. The liar loans, I don't know if you know what liar loans are. They were the mortgage brokers who basically slipped the application across the table and said, you fill it in, with a wink and a nod, meaning whatever you filled in, I'm never going to check on it. And why wouldn't they not check on it? They didn't check on it because they were not going to hold the loan that they were selling. There was that kind of lying, but it's kind of, or sometimes I call it soft duplicity. I don't know if this is even soft duplicity. I think we swim in a sea of soft duplicity when you live in a society based on salesmanship. Was evident on every level. Then to jump at the top level, Standard & Poor's, that is, and Moody's, the two of the main organizations charged with checking whether or not the bonds being sold, the mortgages being sold in those package collateral packages that were being sold in the marketplace, whether they were sound. First of all, this is a kind of an amusing anecdote. I don't know if you know this. One of the skeptics went in to interview them, and their model had no provision for housing prices going down. What goes up will never come down. So it shows to show the rosy kind of thinking that was involved. But also the main corruption there is and it still exists 6 years later, is that the people who are paying them to evaluate those financial products, precisely the people who were selling them. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, isn't the client always right? So under that system, I think it's inevitable that corruption will occur. I don't pretend to be qualified to say what kind of technical fix would be of that, but for me, just how to describe that particular, you're right, there have been bubbles in every era, and the market is, but that's, to say there have been bubbles every era is to recognize that the system isn't rational. It's emotional and psychological as much as it is rational. There's certainly rationality involved in it. And to acknowledge that transforms our political landscape, because a lot of the arguments have been made about political change in this country have to do with the fact that the system is efficient, rational, and productive, when in fact it's often emotional, psychological, and destructive if unchecked. So that's my take.
David.
David Cowan, visiting scholar here at WASI Center. I sympathize with a number of the concerns that you highlighted about modern America, which is also true of what I would question, though, is the link to some of the economic jumps that you're making.
Okay.
I mean, in terms of the housing bubble, I remember giving a presentation, and I was one of those who actually said before the crash it would happen. It was blindingly obvious to a lot of people in the financial industry, so they knew it was on its way. But one of the major causes of it was actually when President Clinton repealed the Glass-Steagall Act.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
The Glass-Steagall Act had been put in place to separate out the retail and the investment banking side
That's
of
correct,
the,
yes.
the business. By bringing those together, then that created an awful lot of problems in terms of how the banks are managing. However, in terms of the crash, if you actually identify all the elements that existed in that crash and any other crash, they have similar elements to the tulip crisis,
mm-hmm.
which occurred before capitalism even came, was a glint in Adam Smith's mother's eye. It was about some basic human behaviors, about greed, about wanting to get more for nothing, about seeking prestige by having the
status.
Most rare
Absolutely.
Tulip. So all of these things, And I would look for the questions to go in the other way, in a sense that to what extent the capitalism and a capitalist economy actually reflects the human behavior rather than in what seems to me coming through from a lot of what you're saying being the cause of it. I mean, if you look at salesmanship and you sort of single out salesmen in particular, salespeople, if you talk to salespeople, they will tell you that they will sell to a customer what they want, and that's basically how they make their money. Tell me what you want and I'll sell it to you. That's a typical salesman approach to things. Not, I'm going to sell you what you don't want. And there's an implication in the critique of salesmanship and promotion and consumerism and branding that there's this sort of all-knowing corporate beast that can figure these things out. It doesn't, and that's why you get movies that crash and burn at the box office. Yeah. That's why you get products left on the shelves at Christmas and all these sorts of things. It's companies trying to second guess. Your discussion about workers, I think a lot of people, frankly, in business will find that to the way you put it as being somewhat insulting, because people working in most companies are, first of all, in far better conditions than any generation before. They're working under better conditions. Factories are in better conditions. The work may just be as mindless as a pin factory. But even then, they get better pay, conditions, holidays, and so on and so forth. Now, why America's always been so stingy about holidays, I don't know. But the way in which corporate responsibility or corporate social responsibilities impacted companies, the number of business ethics requirements, and any CEO that I've worked with, and I've worked with a number around the world, would not fit into the category of the critique that you're implying there, and that it's not just about this sort of pure greed. That's not to say that there aren't ones doing that, but I've also worked in the financial industry, and again, I would say that that's not. It's a bit cartoonish, the way in which sometimes they're made out to be these sort of, what was the novel, Bonfire of the Vanities, that sort of approach. And that was a highlight. I think that was a mood and a fashion of the 80s. But again, I don't think it's caused by capitalism. I think a lot of this is a reflection of some of these human behaviours. I could go on. But
now, let me intervene and just respond, and then on a couple, you may have made a number of points. Some of them I think are quite good. However, one of the early ones you made, I want to sort of focus on and which I think is disingenuous. When salesmen say they only give customers what they want, and I think they're very much in the business of creating desire, and sort of the link that back with the idea of how companies actually behave. Obviously any human activity is an expression of human nature. But to my mind, what's happening is an over-specialization on certain elements of human nature, which unsettle the balance that's necessary for the best behavior, I guess is what I would say. So I agree. I don't think people are always villainous or whatever. I'm talking more about a systemic or moral field, the way it draws behaviors toward, and the lack of checks and balances inside that system. Though there are things, you probably know more about this than like the B companies who try to write into their charters, social obligations. I mean, to me, there's a way of imagining a system that starts to correct itself in a way that we're not seeing on large scale now. Somebody else had their...
Yeah, I was going to just come to Moody's defense and argue that their models did include the fact that house prices could go down in certain regions, but not nationally across the board. But anyway, to follow up on Bob Murphy again, economics department, follow up on the issue of the character of recessions, you know, over the post-war period. This one was very different. It was different in the sense that it was a financial crisis that triggered really the downturn. Previous recessions in the post-war period were primarily oil shocks, where oil prices went up, or Federal Reserve policy engineering a tightening to cool inflation. Mm-hmm. The previous recession that was a financial crisis was the Great Depression.
Yeah.
And so in that sense, we kind of bracket this episode of post-World War II with recessions that in some cases were severe, but were not financial crises with this incredible amount of deleveraging that had to take place in order to pull yourself out. And that's why this has taken so long for us to emerge from the Great Recession. So I guess my point is to ask, if we think about the Great Depression being triggered in this way, do we think about the Great Recession being triggered in this way? But in between, we had recessions that were really a different type. The financial crisis issue really was no longer present. We'd had panics in the 19th century, panics in the early 20th
right.
century. We seem to have gotten policy right coming out of the Great Depression. So I would argue that it's the regulatory structure that we had put in place, the active policies on the macroeconomic front in the post-war era, that by the 80s, 90s, perhaps were getting dismantled.
Right.
And that
right.
it was that shift in policy that then led to the conditions that were ripe for a financial crisis. Just want to see what your thoughts
are. I agree with that. I'm sure you know a lot more about the mechanics of how the policies actually worked and were put in place. And he mentioned the Glass-Steagall Act.
Right.
And the late 90s was a certain critical period, I think, in the end of Clinton's term, where a lot of those transformations were being made by both parties, and therefore there was no real resistance to it. Or those people we've learned. Belatedly learned inside the government were resisting and were basically shut up and
yeah.
didn't have the authority.
But then there was deregulation in the 80s in
right.
the banking sector,
right.
which had some good things involved, but then we didn't think about savings and loans.
Yeah, savings and loans,
that was
yeah.
a crisis that happened earlier but didn't lead to a catastrophe.
I make this observation just about the Great Depression, and again, just a general observation and not one I've thought out because it wasn't part of my, I didn't go over that
mm-hmm.
historical period of my book, but it strikes me as American culture in the 20s was very much like
mm-hmm.
American culture in the 90s and early noughts, as it were, and there may be some relation there between the kind of financial crisis we had and the psychology of everyday life that was taking place.
I think I'll just add on one point that the danger of, and I'm not saying you're doing this, but the danger that I witness a lot was to sort of blame everything on the financial institutions themselves and selling them. And I accept that you are about creating demand. Of course, you have to create the demand, but you also have to be able to second guess that demand is going to be met, and that's where the problems are going. But the flip side of that, there were an awful lot of people who were behaving, consumers, who were behaving as if they were investment bankers or future traders.
Absolutely.
Flipping
yeah.
homes and
right.
trading on that basis without the sort of rational information that you would expect a consumer to have. And they have to bear some responsibility for screwing it
I
up
agree.
As much as a bank. It was
yeah.
and I think you do make reference to it being on several levels. And I think that's one level.
Yeah, I mean, the national savings rate in 2005 plummeted almost zero, I believe, And that's a real transformation from the early post-war years, for example. And so that the whole, both the federal government going into indebtedness and person and individuals going into indebtedness, there's a harmony there. There's a kind of psychology that is working both at government and on the individual consumer level, for sure.
The problem is we have religion being taught in schools. We have sex education being taught in schools, but we don't actually teach basic economics. And you've got to have God, sex, and religion all in the
right.
same thing. We don't do that in the education system.
Right.
So people are not, think, oh, I got a credit card, and responsibility doesn't occur because it's maybe not being properly taught in the first place. At some point, as I tell my kids, you're going to have to pay that off. You're only getting 30 days of interest, and if you spend that, your total in those 30 days, well, you're still going to have to pay it off, and that's where you start getting into.
We had a question in the back here, Yael, and then Alan.
Yael Hungerford, I'm a PhD student in the political science department. I'm trying to wrap my head around the big general arguments you're making in the book.
I was trying to wrap my head around them for a long time, too.
You mentioned the term, I think, monetizing of arts and culture to talk about how the corporate culture has really gone into so many aspects of our lives. I'm not quite sure what you meant by that, but I do know that most, if not all, museums and symphonies and operas in this country are financed primarily by
philanthropists,
often investment bankers, hedge fund managers, and people who own corporations, CEOs of corporations. They're not doing it to make profits in the slightest. They are doing it to presumably to promote aesthetic
beauty.
How does that fit? I see that as a good antidote to commercial life and a very healthy antidote. And I think they see that as well. So how does that fit into the story?
I think that it is part of the story and it's to be acknowledged. And there's been a tradition in American culture, a kind of sotto voce acknowledgement that the acquisition of such large funds requires some responsibility, some payback, and then maybe even that, you know, the system isn't totally fair, and then I should do something to compensate for that and to give back to society. So you have Dale Carnegie, who is, Andrew Carnegie, who was pretty much of a pretty vicious in his financing and treatment of his partners, et cetera. But then he did this wonderful thing of financing all these libraries, and you see Bill Gates, who's in my neighbor, I say Bill Gates, across the lake from me, the similar pattern, you know, and so there's something good about that. I think there's been a transformation, though. I actually wrote an essay about this in Society, if you know it's a sociological view, called The Cultural Contradictions of Philanthrocapitalism. And what strikes me is different this time, and maybe someone who knows the field a little bit better than I do would say, is that before there was that notion you give money back and create these goods that you think are good for the culture. Now it seems to require conversion to the philosophy of how the money was achieved in the first place, results-based. And I know it sounds idiotic to be against results-based things, but the whole methodology of what people need to accept. I'm thinking particularly what's happened in public education through the philanthropic influence of Gates, the Waldron Foundation. There's one other one, I think, that have done a lot of money in that regard. Yeah.
I would just say education is very different than the arts, and that's why I'm focusing on the arts, which is just about beauty and giving beauty to the masses. Well, but education makes sense. We spend a lot of money on education, and we don't have good results. So
right.
Having some sort of evidence-based, experiments going on kind of makes sense in that field.
It does, but I how those things are shaped and formed and what they expect and when, you know, what you measure is what you get. So if you're measuring for results, then how do you measure results? Well, someone in the liberal arts, I don't think, my wife is a public school teacher, so I've had to suffer through this, all these transformations that have taken place, and she's, I have to say, deeply cynical about most of what they've done to the classroom and to her ability to educate her students. Okay.
Alan, you had your hand up, and then come back.
Well, a couple of people mentioned the word responsibility, so I want to say something about that, I guess. I think I heard something very important in what you said, and maybe you could elaborate it a little, and that is that ultimately the responsibility lies with sort of people, what you call it, middle America, or the middle, and not the extremes. Because when I look at the way the responsibility for the recession has been treated, I see people on the left who essentially blame capitalism or the 1% or corporate greed, and I see people on the right just blame government. So everybody's blaming something, but never.
Right.
And there's no internalization that maybe I had something to do with that. I mean, I just don't do that at all.
No, I agree. I do agree. And that partly has to do with the flattery, I think, that's necessary in democracies.
Exactly,
you have to flatter the voters,
so
you don't want to say you were stupid and you were greedy and you shouldn't have done that. You know, it's rare to hear a political candidate,
That's what the market and democracy both have in common.
Yeah.
They have to appeal to
them. That's a good point. That's an excellent point,
yeah.
I think, in some ways. Yeah. The converse side of that is, though, we've moved into, over the last 200 years, society of large institutions. So one of the things I want to get to at the end, maybe pose some questions. We no longer are a country or a colony, series of colonies of rural economic freemen, who are only being informed by print literacy, which, by the way, had no advertisements in it, not until the late 19th century. It's a different, it was a different mode of thinking, different mode of interactions and relations, and how we can imagine our society retaining some kind of ethical continuity within all the transformation of changes, especially the creation of very large institutions. We're the country that has more emphasized individualism, both mythologically, and I take mythologically seriously, I write fiction, I take myth very seriously, than any society I think that's ever existed. And yet we've created technologies that are essentially eliminating the conditions that make individualism vital and realistic and plausible to talk about. And we have not made the transition to that recognition. So what happens is, usually when something goes wrong with these scandals, you want to blame an individual financial leader of a company rather than thinking about the system as a whole, maybe how it works and how consumers are working as well. So I mean, I agree with you. Do you have? I have to ask you back. What's your take on that? On the middle versus the upper end, or the left versus the right on that?
Well, it's, you know, it's hard to answer without sounding anti-democratic. I think maybe I'm increasingly becoming, that it is this relentless quest to flatter people.
Yeah.
And it's probably the single biggest social.
And to me, there's a lack of realism. You know, there's the American, a lot of my book is about, I have a whole book, a chapter on Disney. I think Disney's an incredibly important figure for understanding how he's the person we license to teach our children what's good for society. And I have a, let me see if I can do it. When you wish upon a star, makes no difference who you are. Anything your heart desires will come to you. If your heart is in your dream, no request is too extreme. Now sit back. This is what I was taught. This is what every children was. There's not a single ethical religious tradition that teaches that would treat children's literature that way. In fact, it's almost always the opposite. There are many desires that are too extreme. Almost all of those fables and fairy tales are about moderating desires without denying that they exist. You know.
What about if at first you don't succeed, try again? Come on.
Yeah, go ahead. Oh, I'm sorry. Here first and then over. Go ahead.
I wanted to get back to this corporate sponsorship of the arts.
Can you introduce yourself also, too, please?
Pardon?
Can you introduce yourself to the speaker?
Yes, I'm Pamela Berger. Yeah. I'm in the fine arts. Artistry and film.
Yeah.
And we make a mistake about it. When the corporations support the arts, I mean, we all saw this if you all saw the Roosevelt series, that just, I mean, Bank of America was there lauding all of the positive qualities about the Roosevelt family for about, 15 seconds in this lovely piece, using all Ken Burns' footage, and then, boom, Bank of America comes there at the end. They don't even have to say they sponsor it. I mean, we know they must have given some money, but they want to attach themselves to that ethos. And the American repertoire, I mean, all the theaters and symphonies here, these corporations want to attach themselves to those entities, those artistic entities, because it reflects on them, and people feel more something. I mean, it's a salesmanship job also. They don't do that just for nothing.
Yeah. But on the other hand, speaking against my own argument, there's probably some genuine desire to give something back to the community there too. But it definitely, these days, one thing you notice about PBS, if you watch PBS, is how much the corporate logo comes and how much the sponsors become, they're really advertisements. My question is, are they getting tax deductions for supporting these programs, even though they're really basically providing advertisements?
You have to keep it to a certain, like 2 seconds.
Okay,
like that,
yeah.
You know? But within that, they rule that you can put your name up and your train going by and 2 or 3 horses running, and that's it.
But how would you finance all these productions? I mean, standing around singing Kumbaya is not going to raise.
Oh, well, yeah. When Ken Burns makes a film like that, or it, there is Corporation for Public Broadcasting, Congress, which gives a very, very little bit. Mm-hmm. Then there are individual private foundations that don't necessarily sell anything to the public when people die, who set up foundations and they have family money. I mean, there is a whole list of grants you can apply to that aren't corporate grants, but the Massachusetts Cultural Council, Massachusetts Council for the Humanities, National Endowment for the Humanities, that aren't.
Well, where does their money come from? Their money is coming from
taxpayers.
A similar sort
from
of.
Tax
can
payers.
I just toss in
something
good about technology? There's also crowdsourcing now, which is
yes,
maybe a different way of attracting money from not so narrow wide casting as opposed to, you know, having solely wealthy individuals, but many people are willing to commit. I'm not going to be rosy about that. I'm sure it has a lot of kinks to work out, but that might be another way to use the technology to support the arts in a way that gives an alternative. So you're not just trapped in the same fund. I think it's best to have alternatives for funding the arts and not just have one or two different ways to do it.
We had a few other hands up here also,
yeah, sure.
So let's get in. Sir, could you introduce yourself also?
Yeah, my name's Bernie Franceschi. I'm an elder citizen and card-carrying existentialist. I read the book, and one of the points that you didn't bring up in your talk that I think is really essential, and I'm switching now more to the personal, from the person out rather than the institutions down. And you might call it the development of character, and part of that being the dealing with the negativity of life, whether the suffering, death, and all that grim stuff, but it's always been the character of the human struggle. And, you know, I was a financial advisor for, personal financial advisor for years, and, you know, that we've somehow, if you call it moral flab or something, got into the expectation that, you know, the stock market will always be up, the sun will always be shining. And of course, if you're from the Pacific Northwest, you get disabused of that notion very quickly. But the insulation from pain, from suffering, from distress, from the kind of exigencies of life that are there, but we want to somehow, you know, cover them over. And perhaps, what are your thoughts about how, on an individual basis, we sort of slouched into that kind of character? Because, you know, Burning Meat often put a gun to people's head.
No. Right. I think, speaking sort of long term, the modern idea is improvement, progress. And modernity has given us a lot of progress. You mentioned a number of the elements of that progress. So it's built into us to expect every way I'm going to get better and better, that we're going to get better in certain ways. But there, one negative result of that, even of that betterment, I is a kind of autobiographical chapter. The first chapter has my growing up in suburbia, which is built out of many good intentions. But one of the ultimate motive for building suburbia, as I understood it, to sort of summarize it in a kind of graphic way, is that it's a place where your children would not have to see an unembalmed corpse. And as a parent, that seems, yes, you know, I want that for my children. On the other hand, there's a cost to the notion that you're going to be separated from disease and death, and the reality that that's part of the human condition and the end we all face. And it's a result. Important.
Speak for yourself.
Yeah, right. Or Ray Kurzweil, you know, his book, Fantastic Voyage, Live Long Enough to Live Forever. Ray, who's a very accomplished scientist, believes he is going to live forever through all the pills. He takes 250 capsules a day, Ray Kurzweil does. That's going to keep
him. Forever until we don't.
Yeah. I think he may choke to death. But
Yeah. We had, yes, and then over here. Okay. Go ahead, man. Did you have your hand up? Yes.
Oh, I just wanted to support your point about the system. You know, there's huge inequity and growing inequity between what workers...
Tell us
I'm Sandra Wada from the School of Management. Between what workers make and what CEOs make these days, and what certainly between what hedge fund managers and anybody in the financial services industry is making, and sort of the normal person. And that... Then you get put people in a system where everybody is being bombarded by the media and bombarded by the sort of the cultural norms around them to have the same things that everybody on TV has, to live that sort of lifestyle. And, you know, we know that if you put good people into a bad system, and I don't think that matters what their character education has been, and the pressures are enough on them, that they are going to do bad things because, and that's, I think, the phenomenon of what happened in the meltdown in the global financial crisis, because people were caught up in a system. It's what happened in Enron. It's not that they're bad people to start with. It's that they get caught up in a system that puts all kinds of pressures on them. And companies, Enron, for one, had huge corporate social responsibility policies, great ones. It just was completely corrupt as a business.
Yeah.
So
I didn't know that. That's interesting that they had the first thing you said about it. I wasn't aware of that. Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, do you want to hear and then we'll come back?
Oh, yeah. So I'm Jeremy Evans. I teach philosophy in the Carroll School. So, you know, I'm sympathetic with a lot of the things that you said, but I just want to push back and see what you say about this. So I think the idea, you know, that the kind of over-commercialization and the profit motive is pernicious to our values is, you know, of course, a kind of an old trope. You know, Matthew Arnold, Karl Marx, you hear this a lot. So, but I wonder if whether or not this, in fact, is in conflict with the facts on the ground. So take for example, so Steven Pinker has a book, which, of course, is hugely controversial, suggesting that virtue is up, that, you know, the war is decreased precipitously. In the United States, for example, violent crime is down hugely since the 1990s. Poverty rates are down. Teen pregnancy is down. Volunteerism is up. I mean, you talk to BC students, and the amount of volunteering that they do is, you know, just massively greater than previous generations. And so one wonders, you know, to what extent is this true? Do we, I mean, is that in conflict, these, you know, seemingly improvements in the virtues of individuals, or at least in the measurables? Is that in conflict with this idea that, in fact, commercialization is bad for virtue?
Well, and maybe somewhat in conflict, but you kind of, Pinker is covering a lot of things that, as I understand it, and I'm not totally familiar, I've read more reviews of his book than the actual book, but he was talking about the large arc of modernity, you know, of modern progress, not just the particular slice of American history. And of course, the problem we all face when trying to analyze our own times is the presumption, often the default presumption, that what we're experiencing now will continue on the same forever. And it's not going to. And I suffer those weaknesses as a thinker, too, and constantly have to check myself against them. It's also true that there's a wonderful, one of my favorite Emerson essays called Compensation. When something gets out of balance, there is a natural instinct of human beings to want to counterbalance it. You know, and I think in some instances, like the volunteering, maybe, you know, a natural and good reaction to that, intuitively sensing something's wrong and out of balance, and it should be counterbalanced by that kind of activity. On the other hand, I mean, I do think the corruptions that I'm talking about in the economic ones, correct me if I'm wrong, I think corporate salaries are executive salaries are nine times greater than they were. Have increased nine times since the post-World War period. Some shocking number. And
something like 300-1.
Yeah. So I mean, some of those things are still in place. And what strikes me is I don't feel we really, as a collective political entity, have really responded or corrected or even gone in the right directions as far as to prevent what happened again with the Great Recession.
Go ahead.
Bethel Charcudian, former Boston public school teacher and counselor. I wish you had addressed public education a bit more, especially urban public education.
Yeah.
Talk about an image being very different from the reality.
Yeah.
And when is that crash coming?
Yeah, talk to me. Well, first of all,
the one that's married to a public school teacher.
Yeah. My experience with my wife teaches in a school that has 40-50% free and reduced lunch. So it's a school with, you know, challenged population. She has psychotic kids in her classes. She has kids who mother ran away on the motorcycle with their boyfriend and didn't give the medications to their son. I mean, these are stories I hear, you know, a lot. So there's that aspect of the social dissolution, which is public schools themselves are not going to solve. I mean, people just have to acknowledge that. You can't go to a classroom for 6 or 7 hours a day and compensate for the complete breakdown of the family and neighborhood systems that has occurred in certain areas. So any kind of addressing of that population cannot be just in the schools. It has to be some kind of collective attempt to that reaches beyond and gets into the neighbors and families. And that's a huge issue, and I wish I could say I had a...
I would suggest that the schools themselves are more interested in how they appear rather than what they are. And I'm not going to talk about what I saw.
Yeah. Element of this, and where I was expressing my wife's frustration and mine, too, through her, is she's a very diligent woman and tries very hard to adapt to whatever system they're forcing her to use inside the classroom. And then 3 years later, there'll be another, you know, sort of improvement. So you're constantly reinventing. We have that term, the supposed reinvention is good, but it's not, I don't see real progress taking place. I see changes in test scores. To talk about being cynical, they realize they've changed the tests in a way that scores will come out better, because they're more worried about how they appear than what they've actually taught.
So how does that relate to the demise of virtue?
Well, it relates to the one part of my argument has to do with the overinvestment in rationalized schemes that are going to solve our problems. So, as far as that testing, I'm very skeptical of that. I'm happy for the desire for people outside the school system to be care about it and be concerned about what's going on there. But I feel that there's a kind of delusion about what kind of systems, what's going to work. And on the other end, it works to what Alan was talking about before. It's not just people on the top. I mean, there's been a breakdown of cultural order in certain neighborhoods. I think that some of that has been economically driven, but not in all of it by any manner of means. And that is difficult. It's hard to get that back together again once that's broken up. And certainly, public schools by themselves are not going to achieve that. And that's just realism. No child left behind? Bull. So children are going to be left behind every day. Say that to anybody who's in a classroom, like my wife is an insult to their everyday life, really.
We got 5 minutes or a little less. So if anybody has a brief question that we could throw on the table, that would be great. Do you want to take 3 minutes then?
Okay, so now I'm going to...
We had one more question. Go ahead, sir.
For the School of Theology and Ministry.
Yeah.
I wondered about the... is there leadership emerging from within the system? I think of Warren Buffett and Bill Gates as two iconic leaders who in some way are symbolize, at least to normal, to many people, something quite opposite from the trends that you're talking about. And I just wonder, I think I would make the comment in addition that the high salaries given to CEOs is actually undercutting their moral authority to do anything about some of the things that you mentioned, because it takes away any authority they might have because of the high salary. I mean, it looks like they're in there as much as anybody else out of greed and to take as much out of the system as you can. But I wondered about some of the... But those two people strike me as differing in what they represent from the kinds of remarks that you've been making.
Well, I'm not a big fan of Bill Gates, even though I want to acknowledge the sheer generosity of some of the things he's done and some of the projects. And I, for the reasons I said before, that I think he's changed what philanthropy is operated in America, and to a kind of, you convert to my way of thinking, and the money is there. Essentially, there's a generous donation to the public school system, but it's far less than we pay in taxes as a people, and they have far more impact on what's going on as far as public policy goes, where I think is dubious. Buffett, I seem to me, even though they're good friends and play bridge together, and I well know this because we always get stories about it in the Seattle Times and all the other public papers, he seems to me to be a different kind of character, but I really can't comment about him. I don't know enough about him to say.
So, do you have a two-minute? Can we do a two-minute version rather than
Let me just see. Okay. Americans have reinvented themselves in the past. And the most obvious time to think of that reinvention would be the time of the Revolution. And so, in my hopeful American version of this dark story I've been telling you, which I hope has not given you indigestion while eating your lunch, is that we can, all things have fallen or built again, the quote from Yeats, that it can happen again, we can reimagine ourselves. Nevertheless, it seems to me we are facing a series of very, very, very complicated and questions we are not certain about and haven't answered yet. We don't live in a country of a rural colony of economic freemen whose intellects have been shaped by print literacy alone. And beneath the blame game of our culture wars and even the disagreements we've been having here has been percolating a not unjustifiable fear that our foundational values can no longer make sense of the postmodern place within whose spaces we now think, work, love, and play. Now here's a series of questions I have to ask for you to take away with you. What, after all, does self-reliance really mean in a corporate economy where only a small percentage of that workforce remains fully self-employed? And that's not even a... That's not a criticism of the corporate economy, it's just a description of it. What does self-reliance mean in that new work environment? What do private property rights mean at a time when science keeps discovering new ways in which our private acts can transgress our deeded boundaries to harm or help our neighbors? What do ownership, authorship, originality mean in an age whose technologies, with their linking and webbing and real-time interactions, both expose and enhance the collaborative nature of human creativity? What does freedom of choice really mean when living inside architectural and virtual spaces whose perceptual fields have been designed to seduce us, venues whose moral fields, this gets back to my argument here, have been reduced to servicing commercial intentions? How profound is our allegiance to an existential freedom, whether endowed by a creator or by the forces of nature, when we subscribe to a rational materialist agenda of progress deeply configured by its own belief in deterministic schemes? Can plain speaking survive as a value in a society whose ruling intention has become closing the sale? Can it even be recognized at a time when sincerity itself is routinely faked, when it has become the default mode for damage control in a handbook written by the campaign consultants and celebrity handholders we see all around us? What inherent value does dignity of the individual retain in a digital and televisual culture where the commercially sponsored spectacle is replacing the civic and spiritual ritual, where gossip is subsuming news, and where, as the reality TV craze has repeatedly shown, many Americans now prefer a shameful or even sham notoriety to a life of anonymity, however admirable in the traditional sense? And this demise of dignity as an active value poses questions about the privacy once mustered to protect it. And dignity of the individual and privacy are linked values, I think. In an age where the government feels free to eavesdrop on millions of its citizens' phone calls and emails, when our hard drives are implanted with corporate cookies that report our every digital transaction, when our children are rushing to en masse to post their most intimate facts and photos on Facebook and Instagram, when the once secret diary has been megaphonically outed into the blog, and webcams now stream closeted poses to a global audience of wired voyeurs, in an age of both idealized and vulgarized transparency, can privacy retain anything more than a vestigial value? I have real doubts whether it can, but yeah. Probing the painful divide between our traditional and actual moral identities, these are not trivial questions, and although posing them helps us to map the coordinates of our current confusion, the predicament they sketch will not readily submit to a technical fix. Like Descartes and Shakespeare, like John Adams and Thomas Paine, we live in times that try men's souls, and so are obliged to self-consciously examine and artfully revise the values that are now misdirecting our lives. That's it. Thank you for indulging my opinion.